Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening if you're in Toronto, like Linwood. It's very nice of you all to join us. We are here to talk about The Linemaker, which I counted up, Linwood, since we first met at the Frankfurt Book Fair. This is your 17th book.
Oh, it's got to be more than that. Is that what it is?
Well, not the way I remember, because No Time for Goodbye, you wrote, they've listed 16 here.
So oh, there's four before No Time. There's the four novels about Zach Walker. And in fact, when they did this page, they forgot to put Look Both Ways on, which came out last fall.
Oh, so they did. You're right. Well, no, I said since we met, because we met.
Oh, since we met. Yes. Oh, sorry. Correct. I stand corrected.
Yeah. Well, but no, you're right, because this is the 18th novel that
that's right.
And that I guess it must be the 23rd novel, I guess, altogether.
I think it's that. I don't know. Once you get past about a dozen, you start to not really know what you're doing anymore.
I know. I was just counting up all the years we've been talking to each other.
That's right.
Really doing.
So, yeah. So if we met at Frankfurt, that would have been 2008.
We did. You were there with the British publisher, and No Time for Goodbye had become a raging international success.
Yeah, that was it had already been a big hit in Germany. And then that particular year, it was the top selling novel of the year in the UK.
Yep. So for a guy from Connecticut who lives in Canada, becomes the bestseller in the UK.
For a guy who was once spent quite a long time running a trailer park and burying fish guts. This is better a bit.
Of course it is. You know, I don't think I've ever asked you, why do you live in Canada?
Well, so my father was a commercial illustrator, commercial artist, and he drew, if you looked in Life, Look, Saturday Post, and car dealership folders, the cars were all illustrations. And he was one of the people who drew those cars, these beautiful airbrushed renderings. And there was an advertising agency in Toronto that wanted him to come work for them. And it was an attractive enough offer that my parents thought, gee, you know, should we move to Canada? So they moved to Canada in 1959, just before I turned 4 years old. And so I've been here ever since.
Well, I asked because most of your books are set in the US. Yep. So. You know, and Canada has some great writers, but there's not a lot of cross-border traffic for some reason or other.
Meaning in what sense?
That there are not a huge number of Canadians writing books set in Canada, sell in the U.S., you know, if they have obviously Louise Penny is one, Robert Popey, whom I really admire, is another, Margaret Atwood, but you know,
and when he was still doing his John Cardinal books, there was Giles Blunt,
who was
writing his series about that was in a place that was based on North Bay or whatever up in Northern Ontario. Yeah, it's true. And in fact, there's probably only a handful of Canadian crime writers who are even known outside of Canada.
Well, you're certainly one. I'm going to call you.
There's Peter Robinson, the late, sadly. Peter Robinson, Louise Penny, and myself. And now a friend of mine, Nita Pronovo, who wrote under the name Nita Prose, who wrote The Maid. You know, so there's a few of us. Rick Mathena, who's sold in the U.S. But it's kind of a small club.
Well, I just think Canada has marvelous landscapes. There is a woman named Kelly Armstrong who writes set in the Yukon, for example, and, you know, points to her because the Yukon is such a wonderful. And I found a few other, I'd have to look them up, but there's a wonderful guy who writes about birds. And then there's another one who's written, I'll have to look his, I mean, several really good ones. There are some small Canadian presses. And then, of course, I'm leaving out, I'm going to go blank here. My favorite guy that writes about, you know, Hong Kong and or all the Chinese. Why am I having this blank? I talk to him all the time. He was even like you, a writer in residence here. It will come to me.
Oh, really? Well, there's certainly a lot of writers based in Canada who
Ian Hamilton. There it is.
Oh, yes. That's right. That's right. And of course, there's a great many writers up here who are celebrated all over the world, maybe not in
crime fiction,
Malcolm Gladwell, for example, you know, who's, and Margaret Atwood, and, you know, so forth. So they, people hear about us.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely true. You know, so I mean, I'm just greedy for more books with different landscapes. So that's the reason I kind of brought it up. But anyway, in this case, we are in the United States with a winemaker. And as usual, I don't know how you think this stuff up, but as usual, you have a really interesting idea, an interesting career path for Jack Gibbons. But why don't you fill us in on his background?
Sure. So Jack Gibbons, I think this is the, it's been some time since I had a protagonist who was actually a writer, a novelist. And Jack Gibbons is a novelist of very modest success. He's been, you know, good critical reviews. People think his stuff is good, but his sales have been pretty dismal. And he gets an, you know, a rather mysterious offer to come to a meeting. And he's presented with an interesting gig by the folks who relocate witness, the witness protection folks, the U.S. Marshals. And they say to him, look, we're really good at hiding people and
finding a new place for them to live.
And after they've testified or whatever, we're good at that. But we're not terribly creative when it comes to creating backstories for these people, because they need to have an established backstory, you know, life for themselves to tell people. Because if they start telling people their real backstories, they're going to say, well, wait a minute, aren't you that guy who got relocated and testified and so forth? So they said, you know, we've read your books, you're very good at character. Why don't you, could you do that for us? And it's a very lucrative offer.
And Jack thinks, well, that's pretty interesting. And
it's particularly interesting because when Jack was just a kid, his father left the family because he had done some very, very bad things, but was working for some very bad people. And he was put into the witness protection program and left him and his mom. And Jack is, first of all, astonished that they didn't know this, but now that they do, and he finally tells them,
he thinks maybe if he does this work for them and ingratiates himself with them, maybe they would reconnect him with his dad after all these years.
And as things progress, it appears that there's some urgency to do this because his father may actually be in some kind of very serious danger. So that's our setup. And it's funny, when I did a couple of TV interviews in Toronto yesterday for the book, I did kind of the equivalent of the Today Show in the morning here. And I brought with me a prop. Because, you know, one of the things that when Jack's dad leaves, the last thing he does, he gives to him his wallet, because he says, well, here, kid, and there's some money in it and everything that's in it, my driver's license and my this and that and social security card. I mean, they're all, you know, they're all garbage because I'm getting a whole new identity. And what kind of inspired that moment was this wallet, which is my father's wallet, and which my father died when I was 16. At the very young age of 59. And I hung on to this, and it's been in my desk drawer, whatever desk I happen to have at the time, for more than half a century now. And I've always had it. And I tweeted about it one day. I posted a picture just 50 years ago since my dad died. And here's his wallet, which I still have in my desk. And it sparked a tremendous outpouring on Twitter from people who said, you know, I still have my mom's coat, or I still have my dad's, you know, tennis shoes and all this sort of stuff. And I realized that there was something here. And that's when I decided to take that element of it and work it into this book.
Well, I mean, really for Jack, his father might as well have died when he went into witness protection. And, you know, since he's now lived his life up until this moment without his dad, it turns out to be, well, is it a spoiler to say what Dad did?
No, because in the end of the first, at front of the prologue,
you know, standing there in the rain, the son is pleading for his dad not to go, or at least to take him with him. And he says, can't you just tell these people whatever it is you did, that you're just sorry?
And he says to him, basically, sorry won't cut it, son, because your dad killed people.
Right.
And he was, I think of him as a kind of Michael Cohen, who was took a step further, and you know, a fixer, and so that's in fact what he said. And but there are suggestions that, despite all the years that his dad's been gone, there have been occasional times when there were connections. Although now, all these years later, Jack has no idea where his dad is, and so forth. So, and he's very much would like to find him now, in it, for one very personal reason, which is Jack has met someone very special that he thinks he would like to marry, and he wants his dad to meet her. And of course, it's also going to take some time before he can work up the nerve to tell his future fiance what his dad really did. So Jack's got a lot of things to deal with. He's got a lot of things on his plate. And as he starts writing these backstories, he takes this gig and they just say, look, start writing some just general backstories. And he starts doing it and he realizes this is like trying to make a suit for someone that you haven't met and you can't take the measurements. You know, I can't, it doesn't make any sense. I need to be able to talk to these actual people who are going to be relocated to get a sense of who they are so that whatever backstory I create for them makes sense for them, you know, and as that process starts to take shape, I guess, as they say, mayhem ensues. I think that's the phrase, isn't it? Mayhem.
Well, yeah, mayhem ensues is always a great one, but it's certainly true that, you know, you can't write a backstory for somebody that, let's say, was an outstanding high school athlete. If in fact, you know, that's not feasible, you can't give them, let's say, you know, musical talent if they exactly. are tone deaf. And so I certainly see your point, but here's a mic. Where's Jack's mother in all this?
Well, Jack's mom had, he did, you know, after his dad left when he was a kid, Jack lived with his mom. Right. And then after a while, Jack's mom met someone else who she married, and Jack took that gentleman's last name. And then, but as the years go on, when he was in his, you know, late teens, early 20s, I wrote the book a while ago, I'm trying to remember. Jack's mom passes away. And he maintains a connection with this sort of stepfather figure, Earl. And Earl is Earl is kind of a loser. Earl is always looking for some get rich quick scheme that never seems to come together. And so he's not kind of the father that Jack would have really liked. You know, in some ways, you know, I was asked to do a piece for one of the big bookstores up here, and they had said, who was one of your favorite fictional or like movie fathers? And I picked, because I thought it was very appropriate to this novel, I picked the Tom Hanks character from Road to Perdition, based on the Max Allen Collins, you know, graphic novel. Because there you had Tom Hanks in that movie plays a hitman who's on the run with his son. And he's a guy who's done very bad things, but this bond between Hanks and the son is so strong that you think, okay, I know you killed some people, but I'm kind of willing to overlook that because you seem like a pretty good guy with your kid. So that's kind of was my pick for that particular article. He's my favorite movie dad.
Yeah, great point. But I was thinking, the reason I was asking about the mom is, one, why would it be so important to Jack if he could have introduced her to Lana, to his mom? Maybe it wouldn't have been quite such a big thing. Maybe it would have anyway. But also, you know, Jack's dad, whose actual name was Michael.
Yeah.
I'm a little surprised that the Marshal Service didn't change the name of Jack's mom and Jack, because, you know, you would think that the bad guys wouldn't really want to just go after Michael, but they would also take his family hostage.
Well, and that's something that I talk about in the novel and towards the very beginning. And you know, the people who are relocating, well, they certainly offered to relocate Jack and his mother. But she refused to go. She just said, look, I'm not going to pay the price for my husband's mistakes and bad deeds, and I'm not going to change my name, and I'm not going to let him ruin my life. If you screwed up, you want to go into witness protection, you're gone. Right. I'm not going. And so she's a very headstrong individual, and she just says no. And the authorities say, look, we're going to keep an eye on you really closely, but also the people who would want to get even or get Michael, get your husband and Jack's dad, they know that if anything happens to you two, we are going to be on them just like a ton of bricks. And so she rolls the dice and decides that she's not going to go with them, and she's not going to change her name and so forth.
Wow, that's a really gutsy decision. Whether she went, you know, I can't help but feel that one lever to perhaps bring Michael back out of witness protection or whatever would have been to threaten his family. But anyway, they didn't for whatever reason. So here's Jack all these years later.
Yep.
As you say, not a super successful novelist. I would like to say too, per my earlier discussion about, you know, expatriate writers and so forth, that you gave a very nice tribute in this book on page 48 to one of my very favorite writers. I knew of an Australian writer who had a decent career writing thrillers, but started out writing books for politicians and pop stars. Now, I have had the pleasure of doing the book launches in the United States for Michael Rabotham.
That's certainly who I was talking about.
Of course it is.
I'll have to mention to Michael that I did that if he doesn't get around it.
Yeah, that was Michael Rabotham. I haven't told him about that. I didn't name him. But that's who I was thinking about.
Well, Michael Rabotham is an Australian who lived in England for a long time, did write a great number of ghost stories, and started writing some excellent British detective fiction. And he's moved back to Australia, but he is still writing British detective fiction.
Yeah, he's a very close friend. I've visited him in Australia and had dinner with him at his place in Sydney. And he's just one of our favorite people.
And he
has great stories about when he was ghostwriting one of the Spice Girls memoir on biography for Jerry Halliwell. And he has good stories about, they're very funny stories about that. And he's a lovely guy. And I think he's an absolutely fantastic writer.
He's marvelous. He's won 2 Gold Daggers from the British Crime Writers Association.
Yep.
And
yep.
I've always been surprised that, you know, you would think that his work would adapt well to film. And I think, you know, more of it anyway than one would see.
Well, there's been, I think he's had 2 series made in Germany, and he's had one that was made, an English language one, the one that's based on the woman who's supposedly having a child, and
which is one of my favorites, I might.
Yeah, that was made into an English language series, but I can't remember, I don't think it was made in England. It might have actually been made in Australia, but I'm not certain. And that was done, and I think they even were trying to figure out a way to do a second season for that. So Michael's had, and he's very, I think Germany is one of his top markets. So he's had a couple of shows in Germany. I had a series in France.
Right.
But yeah, his stuff is, I just think he's one of my wife Neetha's favorite writers too. Like, you know, when one of his new ones comes and I get the advanced copy and I go to read it
and it's gone.
And that's because Neetha's stolen it.
In your book, right? You know, speaking of which, we'll digress here for a moment. I'm completely fascinated by the way that Germany does wonderful series for writers who are not writing about Germans or in German. Donna Leon, her Venetian series, is a German film company. Martin Walker's wonderful French books, the Bruno, they are done by a German film company. Currently on MHZ TV, there is an Irish series that is made by Germans. And I find it slightly unnerving, you know, that what looks like Italians or Irish people or whatever, and they're all in Germany. Oh, and there's also one in Barcelona, which is fairly new. And, you know, I find that there's a certain incongruity because the actors also, I mean, I don't think there's necessarily an archetype for every country, you know, in terms of how people look. But some people look more like their country than others. And the actors in a lot of those really look German as speak German. And, you know, and they're supposed to be Spanish, or they're supposed to be Italian, or they're supposed to be Irish. And also I've concluded that it must stem from the enormous market that Germany is.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if she's had any
TV series done on her work, but
our good friend Joy Fielding, whose wonderful condo building I can almost see from our bedroom window, she's just not too far away in Toronto. She's very big in Germany. She's just huge in Germany. And it's always, I always find that interesting about, you know, authors who are really, really extremely popular in one country, and then you would just assume that would go everywhere else. And then yet in others that they're just like not that big a deal. But she's huge over there.
Well, I mean, the French have been doing an astonishing amount of streaming, and they've had great programs like Call My Agent and other stuff. Yeah. So I find it difficult that they have not done Brno, Chief of Police, actually in France and the Dordogne. But I'll see Martin later this year, and I will ask him, because possibly once somebody has signed up, you can't introduce a different country, you know, film company in another country.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really know how it all works.
Yep. Right. True.
So we'll see. All right. So anyway, did you write any biographies for people in witness protection, so to speak?
No.
Did you take a few practice swings?
Well, I bet you that if I did, or if I had done that, I wouldn't be allowed to tell you. So when I say no, you'll just have to take that, you know, as, you know, at face value. No, I haven't done any biographies of anybody. The only biography I wrote was my own, and I did that under my own name, and so that was it. But I think it would, you know, I know other people who've done not for people who are relocated witnesses, but I know people who've done biographies, and I think that's a tremendous project to take on. That's a lot of work to write an actual biography for somebody. Tremendous amount of work.
It's a lot of work. I understand, although I haven't read it, that the guy that wrote Prince Harry's, tell-all, has now written a book of his own about what it was like to write somebody else's book.
There's a big piece about that in last week's New Yorker, which I have, and I have to read. I've been told that it is must-read about the ghostwriting Harry's book.
Well, I think it's supposedly, although I haven't read it, but another writer told me it was an excellent piece on the craft of writing. And then I'm trying to remember who it is. Some bestseller wrote a really interesting book about, and his character's lead character was a ghostwriter, and what that would be like. He's a British, Robert Harris.
I think it's
actually called Ghostwriter.
It's called The Ghost. The book is called The Ghost. I was talking about this with somebody yesterday. The novel is called The Ghost, and the movie that was adapted from it is called The Ghostwriter. And it's a very good adaptation. It's a great movie, and it's a terrific book.
Yeah.
And he has engaged this writer to write this sort of Tony Blair kind of figure, I think, who's, you know, retired, a former British prime minister, and go to this sort of Cape Codish kind of retreat or whatever to do it. And it's a great thriller. But what's interesting, and a lot of people don't even realize until the movie's over, is that Ewan McGregor, who plays the ghostwriter, not once in the entire movie do we know what his name is.
Wow.
It's never said, oh, hello, Mr. So-and-so. It's just all these scenes, he's in hired, he meets with him, and you never, and I can't swear to whether that's true in the novel, but in the movie, you never know his name, but it's just very subtle. But if you just stop and think about it, it's like, what is his name? And it's never given.
That's a really excellent piece of craft. I haven't read it. I mean, it came out, what, a decade ago or something?
Well, the reason I remember is that in 2009 or 2008, I think, the International Thriller Writers, in their best novel nominations, my novel No Time for Goodbye was nominated. Also nominated was The Ghost by Robert Harris. And The Ghost won. And of course, I was understandably deeply bitter. And then I read the novel and I thought, okay, I get it. It's just so good. So I remember reading it right after he had won. I thought, well, I'm going to read this. And it was a terrific book.
It is a terrific book. He's an interesting writer. Like you, he's always coming up with the unexpected. I have read, I think, everything that he has written. And, you know, it's always going to be. The first one I thought is my least favorite, possibly because I'm not crazy about the Nazi and the whole bit. Mm. But I thought Pompeii was a wonderful book. He's written historical fiction, all kinds of stuff.
I've read everything he's done, but I read the one that came out 2 years ago that's sort of set in the future. I wish I remembered the title of it. I quite liked it. And so I'm kind of, you know, I kind of dip into him every 2 or 3 years. I read one of his.
And sort of like actually someone who I'm going to be doing an event with first week of June is Anthony Horowitz.
And he's someone who I haven't read everything, but I've dropped in and here. And I've read all of his James Bond, the novels he's done with the permission of the Fleming estate. There was a time when I thought I would love to write a James Bond novel. And I even talked to my British publishers and said, do you think, you know, if there's even a remote chance, and how does the estate go about doing it, and how do they assign writers? And then I read
Anthony Horowitz's take, and I just thought,
forget it. I cannot do better than this. I'm just not even going to try. And so I think his adaptations are really terrific.
He's done two, hasn't he? Or
three. He's done three. And he's done a really excellent job with it.
The first one was the only time he's actually come to the poison pen.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And I remember being, you know, being awed. Actually, Anthony Horowitz to me will indelibly always be the author of Foyle's War, the, you know, scriptwriter for Foyle's War. Yeah. And Midsummer Murders, which started, yep. I mean, it's gone forever and, you know, becomes probably increasingly implausible as people are slaughtered all over the Cotswolds. But nonetheless, you know, he's had a fabulous career in television as well as a novelist.
Yeah, well, he's kind of, you know, the first weekend of June, there's a festival in Toronto called Motive that the Toronto International Festival of Authors is running. And it's June 2nd to 4, and it's a crime fiction festival here in Toronto. And he's coming for that and some other things. And actually, I'm one of the events that I'm kind of excited about, I have been asked on the Sunday to interview former FBI Director James Comey about his novel Central Park West. Is he going to be coming to see you?
No, he's not. He has signed books for us. It's due out, I think, on the 30th. No, he's going in a sort of a northward, I think, tour arc. It's a date that conflicts with Thriller Fest, because Thriller Fest is that same time frame.
That's
and
right.
It also is the weekend that Joe Nesbo, otherwise, and Megan Abbott and the next Clive Cussler adaptation are all here.
Oh, wow.
So, it's, you know, it's really difficult. I would love to go to the Toronto Festival. I'd really like to have gone to Thriller Fest and gone to the Toronto Festival. But, you know, I have obligations here.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes it really difficult to, I feel like, you know, I would like to go back to Harrogate, for example. I'm sure you've been there I've been there twice, I think. But it comes in the middle of July, and that's a tough time to get away.
I've done Harrogate,
I think, three times. One time we did an event with Laura Lippman, another time with Lisa Gardner, and another time I think it was I think with Mark Billingham.
He's a regular.
I think he interviewed me at Harrogate another time. But Harrogate, it's a lovely. It's a great festival, and it's in such a place. The great place to go.
It is a great place to go. Yeah. For you crime fiction fans, this is the place where Agatha Christie was found after her disappearance in a spa hotel in Harrogate. But Harrogate is an old-fashioned British spa town and lovely. It's in Yorkshire and, you know, in the July, especially as things are getting warmer everywhere, probably Yorkshire is a really nice place to be.
Yeah, well, last time I was there, or the time before, it was really hot. But it's really nice. It's a fun place to go. Actually, last time last time I was there, it was the first time I ever got, didn't happen at Harrogate, but en route to Harrogate, an event before, first time I ever got food poisoning in my entire life, and I got it while on a book tour. That's, I do not recommend that.
No.
It's not a good thing.
That's absolutely terrible. Yes. Well, tell me, what are you working on now? You have reliably produced a book, as far as I can remember, every year. So
I've done a book every year. Some years there have been two. Last year there were two, because I did this sort of little sideways book called Look Both Ways. I have delivered my novel that would come out next year. I have a working title called The Teacher. I don't think my editors have had a chance to read it yet. So that's kind of put to bed, at least the first, I haven't done edits on it yet, but that's done. And I'm doing something right now. I'm writing something a little different. I'm trying my hand at a different kind of thing. I think it would fall more into the category of horror supernatural, which I've not done before, but I'd had this idea, which I won't even tell anybody about now, but I'd had this idea that my agent is just crazy about and really wants me to do this. And so I started working on it a few weeks ago. I have about a third of it done. And then I've put it aside for a while because we're just in the midst of a very busy time between the book coming out and other things and stuff happening. So, but I'll get back to it. But I don't know that it'll be my main book for, of the year. Maybe it might be a little sort of a sideways extra. Because I think, everybody, I think there's a certain expectation of what a sort of a Linwood Barclay book is like. Mm-hmm. And I want to be able to give that kind of book to everybody every year and not have there be one year where I give them something that's completely different. So I don't know, we'll see. Once it's written, my agent may say, no, this is the main book, but we'll who knows?
Well, you're good at the unexpected. I agree with you. There's kind of an understanding of what it would be, but I don't know that that is so far off track. And if you've been paying attention, you will see that the horror genre has been making a screaming comeback.
That's what they tell me. And I didn't even know that. I don't follow that trends quite as closely, but I just had this idea.
And
I've sort of whispered it to the publishers and they seem kind of keen. So I'm going to try to get this thing done.
I think that your fans will stick with you if you venture off into, surprise territory. But I really have been interested. First, it was the Gothic, which I think is kind of a natural outgrowth of Gone Girl. And now horrors are much stronger. For a while, it was like Stephen King carrying it on his own shoulders.
Yeah.
Now there's a whole bunch of it. Stephen Graham Jones has done extremely well. And maybe the real world is so difficult at the moment. Maybe, everybody is happy. The other thing that's making a big comeback is historical crime fiction.
And it's funny, Stephen King's been writing, so much horror. And yet in the last 10 years, he's done a few books that I would categorize as strictly sort of thrillers without any kind of supernatural element to them. I mean, I was fortunate enough to read, he sent me an advanced copy of Holly, which doesn't actually come out till September. And Holly, believe me, Holly is pretty grisly and horrifying, but there's not a smidgen of supernatural or vampires or anything like that. We're set very much in a very real world, if unpleasant.
Interesting. He's going to zig while everybody
else. I know. I was thinking, so that's how we're going to fill the vacuum while he's right, while he comes over to our side of the street. We'll go over there and try to do what he does.
Well, Michael Corita splits the blanket, He's writing his thrillers, and then he has the pen name called Scott Carson, in which he is writing his books that they're supernatural thrillers. And his publisher, I think, encouraged him. In fact, I think it's two different publishers now, encouraged him, to do that, to differentiate them, which really isn't any different than when Ruth Rendell became Barbara Vine. And I think over the years, it's a branding thing, maybe. And maybe that you get a different expectation that people who pick up a Barbara Vine do not expect it to be an Inspector Wexford as written by Ruth Rendell, for example.
I mean, I feel that perhaps publishers are more cautious and worried than they've ever been, and less and not wanting to take risks or take chances. So, you know, so I have to sort of walk this fine line and figure, well, how can I do this that they'll want it? But I think they will, especially if, as you say, it's coming back.
You're right. I think you're not the first person who has pointed that out, that as we've emerged from COVID and with, you know, recession and war and all the politics and all the rest of it going on. But you know what? Publishing has always existed for the next big thing. I mean, that is the most frequent question I am asked. What is the next big thing? And I've been quite good over 30-some years at predicting what the next big thing was. I talked about the Gothic before the Gothic actually got on everybody's radar. And if they stop taking chances and there is no next big thing, then I'm afraid that readers will become bored and, you know, look for other forms of entertainment.
Although I don't think any of us saw Colleen Hoover coming.
No, I have to agree with you. I never saw TikTok coming, nor do I ever actually, well, I was watching Karen Slaughter do a little dance around her hotel room, and I don't remember if it was Amsterdam or wherever she was. And I thought to myself, good for Karen, but I can't see myself doing that book in hand to try to promote something.
No, I think that I don't think TikTok would allow me on. I'm not hep enough for that. They would just say, no, get out of here, you know.
I think you and I doing some sort of strange dance form would just produce hysteria of the wrong kind, not the book buying hysteria.
I don't know. It might crash TikTok if we got on it. I don't think it'd be good.
Well, I think it takes a specific audience to really, you know, and Colleen Hoover would be that author where that audience, you know, would work. But I can't see it for John Sanford, for example, you know, or just would not fly. It's certainly also true, though, that social media is really the channel increasingly where people are finding books and discovering books. I mean, you know, we have found that the biggest audiences we get at the Poison Pen come from the author's social media.
Mm-hmm.
The more active the author, the more likely we will find. And what will happen is that we will get people who are not regular customers, people who've discover the bookstore, so to speak. And that's great because it's wonderful marketing for us. And Sally Hepworth, who I think is a very interesting writer, an Australian writer, came to see us for the first time, trying to think when it was, maybe end of March or something. Anyway, I had no idea what to expect. I knew she was a big bestseller in Australia, but she'd never been to the store. So I had absolutely no idea what we were going to end up doing. And she had a really lovely turnout and it was fun. And she sat down and the first thing she said to me was, I'm so glad to be here. You're famous all over Australia. Seriously?
Yeah.
Not me personally, the bookstore.
Yep.
And, you know, and then I realized that was because Zoom has allowed me over the whole course of the pandemic, in which I think we've now done 1,040 Zoom events since March of 2020 when everything slowed down. So, you know, Michael Robotham, Jane Harper, you know, Solari General, Candace Fox, whatever, Dervla McTiernan, indeed. That's why people know us in Australia. And that would never have happened, really, before COVID and before Zoom came along, which is an excellent tool. I mean, you aren't in Scottsdale, and I'm not in Toronto. So, you know, I'm hoping someday you'll actually come back to Scottsdale.
I would very much love to. I love it there. I love coming to you. I love your store. I love Scottsdale. Of course, you know how much I love the Hotel Valley Ho.
And
their milkshakes. It's anytime chance to come back there would be great.
We'll need to find one. But, you know, I think it's wonderful that meantime, you know, we have a chance to talk in a way that would have been impossible before. And the other thing that works well, Linwood, is that you can put together a group in a way that would not be logistically feasible or financially feasible. And, you know, you and I are here one-on-one, but the truth is we could round it up several writers if we wanted to and had a discussion. So, you know, I like that flexibility that it has introduced. And, you know, I sort of wonder why publishers aren't, you know, taking more chances, because really using tools like this, the cost of promotion is drastically reduced. Oh, yeah.
I know. And I haven't, with all these Zoom events, I haven't missed one flight or lost one bag.
Or had food poisoning.
Yeah. Or had food poisoning.
If you did, it's Nita's fault.
That's right. And she hasn't done it to me yet. So that part is certainly a blessing. It has been pretty good that way. And I've lost count of all the people that I've been able to do. And in fact, I've been able to interview a couple of people who I'd always wanted to meet and got to do through Zoom. I interviewed James Lee Burke for a Zoom event. And, you know, I would have flown anywhere to talk to him to do an event, you know, but we did one and it was wonderful. So it's been really cool to do those kinds of things that otherwise would not have been possible.
Absolutely. I got to do the American book launch for the First Lady of Iceland in her memoir, which was never going to happen. So we've been all over the world. And I can truthfully say that the only thing that's difficult about Zoom is time zones. The hard part is to get everybody to the event at the right time, because we're scattered and, you know.
Well, even I had to tie this pause and think, wait a minute, is Arizona 3 hour time difference or two?
Well, see, we vary. That's the whole problem right now.
So I checked, you know, yesterday I went and I said, okay, I know what it is. So it's 7 o'clock my time. We're going to be okay.
I usually try to add a little note at the top and say, you know, your time, because the Zoom thing says our time. And then our Facebook page and video, it keeps correcting to Mountain Standard Time, which is what we're actually on, because we don't do daylight. And that throws everybody off.
Yes.
So
I know, I was talking to Ian Rankin one day, and
he said, oh, yeah, he said he got this panic call one evening, whatever. He was 1 hour late for his Zoom event. A big book event. He was just blithely going along, having a nice afternoon, whatever it was, and it was supposed to have started 45 minutes ago or whatever.
Yes, well, that could actually happen. One of my weirdest experiences was every once in a while. The other thing about Zoom is that occasionally you could do something that makes absolutely no sense from any commercial standpoint at all. My favorite, actually, of all time was when I did the Owls of Eastern Siberia. And I'm telling you, this author, who was a lovely guy, had the most fabulous video, because he was a naturalist, and he's, you know, so basically our event was almost entirely this terrific video and stuff he did. And then he went on to win a National Book Award. So that was great. But the other one that I particularly liked, it was a Don at Oxford who, is an economist, but he had written a book about English landscape gardening, but he was looking at it from the economic standpoint of the kind of income that these gardens generated, apparently first in their construction, and then, you know, as a tourist device, you know, visiting whatever, anyway, and then, you know, selling plants. Anyway, the whole thing was fabulous. So I held up my hand, you know, and said, I would love to talk to him. And as we got going, Patrick and he were talking along, and I have no idea what happened, but all of a sudden my Zoom, you know, it all went away.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, I have no idea what to do. I don't know how to get to Zoom on my phone. So I am frantically worried, trying to, you know, looking up the thing, rushing over to my, getting back, you know, figuring out how to punch in on my phone and the whole bit. And eventually, by some alchemy that I will never understand, I probably could never replicate, I managed to get back into the Zoom event. And yep. He's still talking. He has missed me. It was so great. Really, and it was a lovely book. I mean, I really, you know, we sold some copies of it, but I think, you know, the opportunity to do things that would normally never come up has been fabulous. So
yeah, and you know, and with the exception of your location, you know, going on a U.S. tours they're tough, because you know, it's a big country and you fly every day and you know, you're in airports every day and you're waiting around, the flights are delayed, and so there can be, they can be pretty grueling, because compared to when I go over and do like a UK tour, where even if you're flying, they're like half hour flights, or maybe the absolute longest would be an hour. And you mostly are you taking trains or cars or stuff. And it's far less hard on your system. And you know, and trains are fun, and you know, and you don't have to be in airports too long. So those are pretty manageable, but US ones kind of, and or Canadian ones, if you're doing Canada and you're going out to BC or whatever, like yeah. I went to the Vancouver International Writers Festival last October. Those are pretty big distances.
They really are. Although, you know, if you get to go to Vancouver and you can take the Rocky Mountaineer, come on, Linwood.
Well, I mean,
truly one of my favorite train trips ever is Vancouver to Banff. Wow.
That would be nice. That would be, I haven't had that pleasure. No, I went to Vancouver, and I've been up to Whistler, and I've been over to on a seaplane to get over to Sechelt for the Sunshine Coast Festival, and so forth. But I haven't done that Rocky Mountaineer thing. I would like to do that. Sounds great.
You know, it truly is. Do not do it round trip. By far, the best way to go is Vancouver, and you rise up, and you have the big finale in Banff. But we did it round trip, and it's not the same going from Banff back down again. It's a different trajectory.
I've driven through it. I've driven into Banff through the Rockies and Lake Louise up to there. And it's just stunning.
Yep, but it's different to go on the train. Yeah. Anyway, we've dithered around here. I know what I wanted to do. I wanted to finish up by quoting, because Linwood, as always, gets fantastic reviews. And he has a starred review for The Lie Maker, and let's see, this is how it starts. Barclay nails this riveting standalone thriller about a washed-up writer's search for his long-lost parent, and a wrenching prologue. 9-year-old Jack Evans is separated from his father, who enters witness protection with blunt parting words, "Your dad's not a good person. Your dad killed people, son." And then it ends after blah, blah, blah. Barclay expertly knits the strands together and constructs the fully realized everyman in Givens. Crafty plotting and rich characters make this a winner. I mean, come on, wow. They couldn't have said anything nicer than that.
That was a check worth sending.
Right. Seriously, that was a really fabulous review.
That's a nice review. I have had a lot of people say to me that they think this is my best book. And I think that when you're the author, a lot of times you just don't know, you know, and you're waiting for this kind of what is the reaction going to be? And I have other books that I have done that I would think are probably my best ones. But then people have read this, they said, no, they think this is the one. So, I mean, it just seems rude to argue. You know, if you think it is, that's great.
The kind of writer you are, and the fact that you do so many different books, I think there's a real, you know, oranges and apples kind of a thing to try to locate a best book. I mean, a best book, how is it your best this or is it best that? You know, it's not like you're writing a 20 book series and people can say, well, this is when Parker was, you know, and Hawk were better together than not. I mean, I loved Elevator Pitch, I have to say, partly for the title, because I thought it was an absolutely brilliant title for what happened to it. But, you know, I don't know that I could say that I have a favorite of your books. I like them all. So, Jacob, why don't we call you up and see if there are any comments or questions from the audience? Hi.
We certainly do have questions. This one's from Stefania. And she says that you are one of my favorite authors. I really love your stories. Do everyday events, news or personal, or your emotional state of the moment affect in some ways your writing? Thank you.
Affect, I don't know if they, emotional state, I mean, I think that no matter what you do for a living, your emotional state can affect, you know, how things go. If you've got, you know, things going on and there's that death in the family or someone's not well or any number of things like that can affect it. But if the question is also about whether certain events are what sparked the writing, Sometimes there will be, you know, some sort of event. It can be personal, it can be something in the news that will spark the idea for a novel. And what the novel finally comes to be may be something very different than what sparked it. But there's that little thing that lit the fire. Barbara mentioned the novel Elevator Pitch, which was about a guy, different kind of serial killer who kills people by sabotaging elevators throughout Manhattan. And that whole book came because in Toronto, where there's this massive condominium high-rise developments, they just said on the news one night that they didn't have enough elevator inspectors to keep pace with the development of construction. There hadn't been a problem, but they were just short of inspectors. And I heard that on the news, and the idea was just there. What if you had a guy who was deliberately like sabotaging elevators? And I have to say, Barbara, just as a note, in England, there were readers who said, why wasn't it called Lift Pitch?
I know, we talked about that, right? That's one of those things where we're divided by a common language. But do you know what else I remember about Elevator Pitch? Was you're the first person who ever talked to me about smart elevators. I had no idea that they were even feasible.
The other thing that was cool was that there's people who ride them for fun on top. They open the door a floor above where the elevator is, and they ride on top of the car, and you don't even know they're there. Kids do it and so forth. That was another thing I found. That was cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Stefania is from Italy, so I'm glad you're not up as late as usual, Stefania, watching.
All right. I would like to know your opinion about banned books. Are books that scary? And can they be weaponized or dangerous?
Well, I'm just outraged about all these moves to ban books. I mean, do you think that has there been any book ever written that you couldn't find someone to object to it? And if every school is dependent upon pleasing the parents, every parent of the several hundred kids that they have in the school, then you might as well just have no books whatsoever. I think people who ban books and are fighting to have books banned are just terrified that their world is so fragile that nothing that is even slightly outside of their realm, anything like that, can sabotage it, can shatter it. I think they're living in perpetual fear of other ideas and people who are different. And I'm just, you know, we're supporters of Penn Canada here in Canada. We're patrons of Penn Canada. And the whole notion of banning books is frightful to me. And can books be dangerous? I mean, I suppose that's probably true. But, you know, there's a whole industry of publishing of, you know, books by right-wing individuals like Ann Coulter or the late Rush Limbaugh and so forth and so on. And I don't intend to read those, and I'm not going to buy them for anybody for Christmas, but I'm not going to stand on a soapbox and say that they shouldn't be sold or that have to be banned or that you can't read them. But on the other side, it's like, that's perfectly okay. We're going to tell you what you can and you can't read, and it's an outrage.
Thank you. That's a very powerful statement. I am absolutely outraged by it. The outrage. Other thing I would like to say is that many books that are banned turn into classics.
Well,
and,
of course.
You know, just banned at the moment doesn't, it's just a fleeting moment of cultural, you know, upheaval and outrage. And the two moms in Florida that are responsible for a great deal of it, I hope someday will be held to account.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Great. What's your relationship with social media? Do you have, do you find it that it helps as a writer stay in touch with your readers, et cetera?
Oh, sure, it does. I mean, I'm the only ones that I really use. I mean, I have an Instagram account that I never do anything with, but my publisher does, and TikTok
doesn't even exist for me.
But I'm on Facebook and Twitter. And I think the one I like the most, even despite its current owner or whatever, is Twitter. Because it's so kind of immediate, and it is a great way to keep in touch with authors. I'm
on the phone
an awful lot all day because, you know, I post
Lawmaker
came out yesterday in North America, and first thing you hear is somebody says, well, when is it coming out in Australia? When is it coming out in England? They really want to know, and you try to do your best to try to keep people informed, and you know, writing is a very isolating profession. And certainly in the past, before we had, you know, the pandemic, there were occasionally, you know, once a year, you'd go out there and you'd meet your readers. And we don't even have that as much now or have in the last few years. So there is a way to keep in touch and connect with people. Twitter I like because, for one reason, you know, I worked in newspapers for 3 decades. And for the half of that, I was a columnist. I was an opinion columnist. I wrote satirical humor column for 3 a week for the Toronto Star. And so if I had a kind of an axe to grind or something I wanted to mock or have or take a run at, I would write a 600 word column about it. Well, I don't have that anymore, but I have Twitter. And so, and I find that if I get this idea that would have been a column, I will knock it off in Twitter in a sentence, which means clearly that the columns were grossly overwritten.
You needed editing, yeah? That's a really interesting thought. So the vehicle, the publication vehicle has a lot to say or a lot to do with, right.
You know, I'm very opinionated on Twitter, and there are some people who say, hey, we don't want to know what you think about this or what you think about Trump or whatever and so forth. And I think, yeah, this is why I became a writer, to keep my opinions to myself. So you know, if you're not happy with what I had to say, you don't have to buy my book. But if there's people, I think I'll gain as many on the other side. And think, yeah, I like that. So. You know, you take your chances.
All right. This question asked, what is a book that you never get tired of reading and why? And I'll even add to that. I mean, do you have any a book particularly that inspired you?
I'll go to the last part first. So this is not what people want to hear necessarily, but what inspired me to write was when I was a kid. I started writing about when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. And what inspired me to write was television. I had favorite TV shows. And so I would, you know, episode a week of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or Mannix or whatever wasn't enough for me. So I would take those characters and write my own stories. And my dad taught me how to type. And I would write 30, 40 page novellas when I was 12 years old. And so that was my initial inspiration. But as a kid, I was reading the Hardy Boys, and I was reading, and then I graduated to Agatha Christie and devoured all of the Nero Wolfe books by Rex Stout. And then in my teens, I discovered the Lou Archer novels by Ross McDonald that I became completely obsessed with, to the point that I actually got to know him personally and have dinner with him when I was 21 years old. And so Those were kind of influences. And I think there was a first half of that question, and I've already forgotten what it was. What was the first half of that?
The first half of the question was, do you have a book that you never get tired of reading?
You know what I go back to all the time? When I just want just to have something fun, I go back to and I read early Robert Parker. I'll pick up Early Autumn, which is I think of all the novels he wrote, it's my favorite. I've reread a lot of Parker's through the pandemic. I find, because they're just, especially if you've just read some 500 page opus or whatever, like I would read Ken Follett's Never, which I loved, and it was so depressing and so horrible by the end. I thought, now I just need a Parker, and I'll read Early Autumn or Looking for Rachel Wallace or one of those early ones, because they're fun and they're crisp and the dialogue sparkles and I know these people and I like them. And you know, it's not easy to write stuff that's that easy to read. You might think it is, but it's not.
But there's a plug for Mortal Stakes. That's my favorite Parker.
Great one. That's a really good one too. Those ones all kind of written in that period. And then I started rereading the ones that he wrote at the very end of his career, which many have thought were really kind of not quite as good, not as good as his early ones, but I found a lot to love in those too.
The dialogue was still, which was in part
dialogue, always part of
genius at dialogue.
And then they put in a word for Ace Atkins, who for 10 years did a magnificent job of taking on the Spencer novels. I know he's not doing any more, and he'll be missed. He did a great job on those.
He will be, but I'll tell you what, Mike Lupica, really, or Lupica, I never can remember which way he pronounces it, really has a great sense of humor. And I was impressed with a couple of Sonny Randalls he's did, mm-hmm. Jesse Stone, and he is taking over.
I know he's going to take over writing the Spencers. I wonder, you haven't read an advance yet?
No, because it's not due out until I think December or something. Okay. So the machine hasn't quite come up for it. And we are fortunate that we generally get to do Parker's here at the Poison Pen, because
I'm
here a lot. And
I'm very curious to see how he does with it.
Based on what I know so far, I think he'll do well. Ace really updated Spencer, and mm-hmm. Mike will then have to, you know, run with that, because it's hard to turn the clock back on the different Spencers. So we'll find out. All this legacy publishing, I think, is completely fascinating, whether it's the Clancy's or, you know, the Parkers, or, you know, Robert Ludlum's in the mix, and now Stuart Woods is going to have a legacy, author and Brett Battles. And the Sonny Randalls have been taken over by Allison Galen, who's going to be here with that. And in fact, I have the manuscript right over there, which I'm going to read this evening.
She's great. She's a really good writer. I bet she'll do a great job.
But, you know, I'm with you. Parker was always my comfort writer, my go-to when I, you know, wanted to lift or anything.
Yep.
I right. Agree. Sorry, Jacob. That was a digression.
No, not at all. That's it for questions.
Oh, okay. Well,
okay.
Great. So we ended up on a positive note, recommending an author that Linwood and I both really like, namely the late Robert B. Parker. And I do think that the authors who have continued to write in the Parkerverse have really done a very respectful, very good job. Reed Farrell Coleman, Ace Atkins, Mike Lupica, now Allison Galen. Am I missing anybody?
Was it Michael Hardman? I think he did some of the Jesse Stones. Was that his name? He had written some of the Spencer. The Jesse Stone. He wrote some of the Jesse Stone TV movies.
Michael Brandman.
Brandman.
Yep, you're right. And then there were a couple of the Parker Westerns, but I haven't seen Robert. I can't think of his name.
Knott. Robert Knott.
Yeah, Robert Knott, K-N-O-T-T, wrote a couple of the Westerns.
Yeah, but I've read a few of those.
Yeah. So, you know, for fans, that's the thing for fans. It's really hard to lose an author, but for fans, it's even harder to lose the characters. So, you know, it's great in a lot of ways that they get to continue. Well, we've been talking to Linwood Barclay about The Lie Maker, which published yesterday.
Yes. Right? Yep. And if anyone's watching from the UK, it's the end of August. Comes out
there. Isn't that much later?
It's usually the other way around. Usually the UK gets it earlier, but it didn't work out that way this year.
I see. Well, as always, Linwood, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Let's try to figure out a way to bring you here next year.
Sounds like a plan.
I think that would be wonderful. So good night, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.